Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome to Conversations. I'm joined today by Ron Brownstein, senior editor at The Atlantic, senior political analyst at CNN. In my opinion, one of the best analysts of American politics.
Thank you. So you combine good to be here.
A rare combination of detailed, granular understanding of electoral matters and the big historical sweep. So I've now put a big burden on you.
Thank
here.
You. Thank you. Well, we are living in a big,
To live up to this introduction. So yes. I think we talked a year ago. And now we're more than a year and a half after the election, only 4 or 5 months till November 2018. What's changed over the last year? We analyzed 2016 a little bit last time, but so where are we now here in June, July of 2018?
2018. I feel like every crevice, every fissure that we talked about in 2017 and that we saw in 2016, maybe even deeper in 2018. I mean, to me, the Trump presidency has said more about the country than about him. I mean, he has been erratic, volatile, racially divisive, but who would not have expected those things from 2016? In many ways, he has been somewhat at the far end of kind of disruptive from what we thought, but not out of bounds of what we anticipated he would be as president. I think what's striking is the extent, is the reaction of the country, really, and the extent to which our divisions are so solidified, so immutable, that even a figure as disruptive as Trump is doing more to intensify than fundamentally realign the basic divides, partisan, geographic, demographic, and generational, that he inherited.
Do you think these were so deeply, I want to ask you now to elaborate on each of those divides, but I was thinking about this, I mean, do you think these were so baked in that it was almost inevitable that he went in that direction? Because it wasn't crazy to think, I don't think, in December or so of 2016, that he could go against Tide.
Yeah.
He wasn't a big ideological conservative on so many issues. He could have gone with infrastructure. He could have gone against the drug companies. I mean, there are 18 different ways he could have been a populist who attracted some Democrats or many Democrats in some issues and almost betrayed the Republicans. Would that have been possible? Are the divides just too deep or just too easy to fall into the divides, or he had appealed to them too much already?
The first thing is, I mean, I think Trump has clearly, and I think you would agree, clearly offered the Republicans a kind of devil's bargain, where in essence he is saying, I will give you many of your longstanding goals. I will cut taxes. I will slash regulation. I will appoint conservative justices. I will turn over all of these regulatory agencies, in essence, to the regulated industries. Things that congressional Republicans and Republican voters, by and large, want. And in return, you have to take the distinctive elements of Trumpism, which is this kind of insular nationalism on immigration and trade and skepticism of alliance and open challenging of the rule of law and undermining federal law enforcement and this endless series of openly racially provocative culture fights that he provokes on Twitter and elsewhere. And, you know, you could imagine this blowing up on either end. You could imagine that either the kind of economic vision tilted toward the top would be so severe that it drives away some of the blue-collar voters drawn toward his cultural populism, or that the racial and cultural populism could be so divisive that it drives away some of the upscale voters who, you know, basically like the small government economic agenda. And there's more of the latter than the former, more of the white-collar than the blue-collar, but there isn't that much of either. And, you know, at the moment, the thing is kind of shambling forward. You know, it constantly looks like the gasket could blow and the machinery could blow. But the fact is that as this has gone on, and particularly I think the tax cut was a turning point, when Republicans saw there was this tangible benefit, that not only Republican elected officials have locked arms around Trump more than I would have anticipated 18 months ago. But more of the typical Republican coalition is willing to say, I'm not 100% happy about all of this, but I'm sticking with it for the time being. Right. The price of all of this, though, is that you have intensely mobilized and terrified, really, the other side. And also, there is, I think, a measurable cost among white-collar, center-right adults who may not call themselves Republican but normally vote Republican. And we are seeing more of those, especially women, pull away.
So Well, just on this question of whether he could have done it differently, I guess you just don't know. Well, he could be a different person.
So, but to do it differently, I mean, you know, I think that the biggest problem, there are a couple problems with doing it differently. One, did he really have like kind of a vision of like, you know, what a carving out a piece of each party? I mean, Henry Olson, I thought, you know, the conservative writer, you know, made the argument to be early on. If you really want to do this differently, you have to have a vision of how to attract not only supermajorities among working class whites, but also make inroads among working class Hispanics and African Americans. Because if your only mission is to max out on working class whites, yes, they're a big group, but they are shrinking. They are shrinking 2 points as a share of the electorate every 4 years. The problem is Trump's vision of how to max out on working class whites is so rooted in generating fear, I think, of minority voters that it's just hard to imagine how you're going to turn around. Like, is an infrastructure plan going to win a lot of Hispanic working class voters if you're basically saying that undocumented immigrants from Central America are infesting and invading the country? I mean, it just, to me, it was always somewhat implausible. Plus, Congress is now so parliamentary, you know, over the course, I mean, we met in 1986. And when you think about, you know, people like Robert Stafford and, you know, who the Republicans were, I think 1/3 of the Senate Republicans voted against William Bradford Reynolds when Reagan tried to promote him to the number three job in the Justice Department. And, you know, nearly 20 Republicans voted against each of Carswell and Haynesworth, Nixon's Supreme Court nominees. So we're not in that world anymore. And so he couldn't pull the Nixon.
I mean, Nixon would be the example of
And Nixon did.
Did. I mean, he got from 43% to 60% of the vote in 4 years.
Yeah, he did. And he had this kind of, you know, strange combination of the Southern strategy appealing on some levels to racial resentments, but also governing in a way that what incorporated and embodied a lot of Democratic goals, particularly on the regulatory side, the EPA and OSHA and the Coastal Zone Management Act.
Upper middle class Republicans happy enough, at least.
Exactly.
And of course, it's helped by McGovern.
I mean, Trump, I think the Trump thing is, what makes Trump unique is I don't think there has ever been a president. There have been presidents who you could say were somewhat obtuse or uninterested in the voters outside of their coalition. People felt that way about Obama. People felt that way about Bush. Trump takes that one step further because I think he views a way of solidifying his hold on his coalition is to be overtly hostile
to the other coalition.
And I think one of the reasons why he's so popular with so many core conservative constituencies is that he is a wartime president. Only the war is against blue America.
Yeah. And I think this whole analysis depends on something you've written about an awful lot. You should walk us through a little bit. So what are the two coalitions? I mean, what are we really looking at here?
Yeah, you know, I've been writing about American politics since the 1980s. And in some ways, the biggest change is that now all of our social and economic divisions align with partisanship in a way they didn't before, right? I mean, even when I was writing in in the 90s, Bill Clinton won half the counties in America in each of his two victories. He won a lot of blue-collar voters. He won a lot of rural white voters. He won a lot of, you know, culturally conservative voters. We've kind of evolved beyond that. And we've moved to a point where you have a Democrat, every cherry on the slot machine now lines up, cultural, demographic, and economic. You have a Democratic coalition that is stronger with younger voters and a Republican coalition that's stronger with older voters. You got a Democratic coalition that's increasingly competitive with white-collar whites and a Republican coalition that's dominant with blue-collar whites. Obviously, you have a huge racial divide in the electorate, with Republicans still, you know, facing a ceiling at around 20%. Among the growing share of non-white voters. You have this incredible geographic divide where Hillary Clinton won 87 of the 100 largest counties in America. She won them by over 15 million votes. Those 100 counties alone provided over half of all of her votes, right? But there are another 3,000 counties in America, and Trump won about 2,600 of them, which is more than any candidate in either party since Ronald Reagan. If you look at it economically, you have Democrats are centered in these globally connected, info-age, low-carbon metro areas, and Republicans are rooted primarily in rural places where, if you look, the data shows that a disproportionate number of the manufacturing jobs, obviously the agriculture jobs, and also the energy production jobs are located. So when you add it all up, I believe we now have a coalition of transformation, a Democratic coalition of transformation that is rooted in the larger cities, that is younger, more diverse, more white collar, more secular, more rooted in the global economy, more info age, and a Republican coalition of restoration, coalition of restoration that is the opposite. It's older, predominantly white, more religious, more rooted in those traditional industries, and increasingly blue collar. I mean, just take a couple of the contrasts. Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, give the real numbers, Hillary, because one could say, well, look, every party, of course, by definition almost, is going to have a different tilt on all these different axes.
But these are really pronounced tilts. Clinton won 16 of the 20 states where immigrants are the highest share of the population. Trump won 26 of the 30 states where immigrants are the smallest share of the population. If you look at per capita carbon emissions, which is, turns out to be a surprisingly useful kind of gauge of the economic structure of a state, because they're lower in the kind of the post-industrial states, and they're higher in states that are either manufacturing or energy production. Same kind of thing. I mean, Clinton won, I think it was like 18 of the 20 with the lowest, and Trump won all of them with the highest. Look at religion. You know, today, and part of the reason why the Trump phenomenon, I think, is so intense is because we are continually crossing these demographic milestones. Somewhere around 2005 or so, for the first time in American history, white people without a college degree were no longer a majority of the country. Right? It might have been true from Jefferson, Jefferson's yeoman's farmer to the guy on the line at the River Rouge. I mean, they were always a majority of the country. That stopped being true sometime around 2005, 2006. Sometime around 2010, white Christians were no longer a majority of the country. White Christians are now down to about 42% of Americans.
People who say they're Christian.
People who say they are white and Christian, right. Some Christian religion. And so we're down to about 42%. But think about the divide. Three-quarters of self-identified Republicans also identify as white Christians, which was the share of the country overall in 1984, when Reagan was reelected. Among Democrats, only one-third are white Christians, one-third are non-white Christians, and one-third are secular. So, you know, no matter how you want to slice it.
So that's interesting. So a party that's three-quarter white Christians, self-identified Christians,
right,
and a party that's one-third white self-identified Christians are
going to
have a pretty different view
of
the world, set of priorities.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, one of the things that Trump did.
Say a word about education and gender, too, because there the gaps are pretty big, too, I think. Right.
Right. So, you know, we saw by far the biggest gap in this election between college-educated and non-college whites. Now, among minorities, education is not that big a divide. A little bit, but not a huge divide. But among whites, you know, the realignment and transformation of American politics really follows what I've called, and I think we talked about last time, the class inversion, which is that if you, that's the phrase I use, if you go back from Roosevelt really through Jimmy Carter, the early 1980s, Democrats are the party of people who work with their hands. Republicans are the party of people who wore a suit to work. And the measure of that was that every Democratic nominee from Adlai Stevenson, which is when we begin to have reliable polling, through essentially Walter Mondale in 1984, so 52 days, every one of them ran better among whites without a college degree than whites with a college degree, usually a lot better, 15, 20, 25 points better among non-college than college whites. And, you know, starting in the 60s, for all the reasons that, Archie Bunker embodied, or Joe in the movie, Republicans chiseled away at that Democratic advantage among working class whites until you get to 84 and the Reagan Democrats. And the Republican Party has never looked back. I mean, Republicans have been routinely winning 60% or more, roughly around 60% of working class whites, whites without a college degree. Trump, again, pushed that to the max. He drove that number up to 67%. And he not only, which was the highest.
Wasn't it sort of the conventional view that you really can't do more than 60? I mean, there's just enough Democratic
economic
interests among union members and so forth that it's never going to go beyond.
Let me tell you, in the exit poll, people don't talk about this much, and certainly the AFL doesn't talk about this much, but in the exit poll, again, who knows how right it is, 58% of non-college whites in a union household voted for Trump.
Wow.
And not only did he dominate among the men, but I think we talked about this last time, I think the single biggest reason he's president is so many working class white women in the Midwest voted for him. He won over 61%, according to the exit poll, 61% of working class white women nationally, non-college white women, and really dominated among them in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, all the states that tipped the election. So on the one hand, you've got this Republican Party that had been moving in the direction of an increasing strength among blue-collar whites. Trump pushed that further, and we can talk a little bit how much of that looks different now. But, you know, the reverse started happening. which is that the college whites, who are usually reliably Republican, became more competitive for Democrats under Clinton, under Gore, under Kerry, under Obama. Gore ran 4 points better among college whites than non-college whites in 2000. Kerry was 6. Obama was about 7 both times. And what was Clinton? 17, 18 points better. I mean, so, and in this election, the chasm is going to be enormous again, I think, in the midterm, and I think in 2020 as well, because, I mean, the evidence is that there is a real backlash against Trump and Trumpism among college whites, mostly women, but to some extent men, and that his hold and the Republican hold on blue-collar and rural whites looks pretty undiminished to me, with some possible erosion among the women. Blue-collar white men may be even more pro-Trump now than they were on Election Day.
So, listening to this, so for someone like me who would like to save the Republican Party for Trump, from Trump, and would like to focus on the issues, in a sense, in which Trump, both the issues and the whole matter of governing, obviously, rule of law and so forth, the ways in which Trump deviates from, let's just say, Reagan Republicanism, and they're pretty big deviations.
Or constitutional.
Or constitutionalism. Even the Tea Party kind of constitutionalism, which is what everyone thinks of aspects of it, was, I think, earnest about limiting government, reducing the size of government, don't play favorites, a kind of rule of law of a certain kind, constitutionalism, originalism, all that's just totally other. So for someone like me who focuses on that, I say, well, gee, Trump's really transformed the party. And of course, for me, it's distressing how much the party has let itself be transformed, seems to have let itself be transformed by Trump. From your point of view, in a way, from the other, looking at it from the other side, the, let's say, the socioeconomic base of the party as opposed to these issues, it doesn't look quite as much as a
it looks like an acceleration.
It looks, not a transformation. Not
an acceleration, but a self, you know, the thing about these kinds of changes in the composition of a party is that they tend to be self-reinforcing, right? So I look at it like, you know, the Republican primary electorate now is roughly 50-50 college and non-college. That's been the case in the last three primaries. But the history is that the college side, when the two have split, have usually been able to pick the nominee. If you think about Reagan in 80, they didn't really split. If you think about W in 2000, they didn't really split. But in 08, they split, and the college side broke for McCain. The non-college side broke for Huckabee, in part because so many of non-college Republicans are also evangelical Christians. And the college side won. You know, the white-collar side of the Republican Party got to pick the nominee. Same thing happened in 2012. Where you had the college side consolidated behind Romney and the non-college side largely consolidated behind Rick Santorum, which, you know, is a pretty thin reed on which to have to, you know, put all the weight.
But Santorum and Gingrich together, one forgets,
were formidable. Right. And the white-collar side won.
Yeah.
You get to 2016, you know, the analysis that was done at the end of the primaries, only one-third of college-educated Republicans voted for Trump. In the cumulative analysis of all the exit polls, but half of the non-college Republicans did. And so for the first time, the non-college side picked the nominee. And the nominee reflected, in, I think, pretty fairly the hopes, fears, and priorities of those non-college Republicans. Very anti-immigrant, very skeptical of trade, very skeptical of foreign alliance, really not interested in the Ryan agenda of cutting Medicare and Medicaid, perfectly happy for social welfare programs that they saw as benefiting people like them. They don't like transfer programs, so that they're okay with because they see that it's going to, you know, quote, the undeserving poor. So what is so basically, Trump's victory has required, since his election, the governing Republican Party, which is pretty much ignoring that blue-collar side of the party, to absorb, you know, all of that, accept all of that as the price of getting their stuff. I mean, I think sort of what Trump's implicit, you know, case to Republicans is like, McCain lost. Romney lost. I figured out how to pick the lock. I tore down the blue wall, you know, my phrase from 2009. I feel like, you know, there it goes, watching it crumble on election night. You know, I figured out how to tear down the blue wall. None of these other guys did who were kind of effete and, you know, country club. I figured it out. So sit down and be quiet, because if you want to get your judges and your taxes and your regulatory, you got to put up. You may not like this stuff, but this is what gives you the power to do it.
And people like me can say it to a blue in the face, so to speak. You know, look, it wasn't even get many more votes than Romney, and it's the same percentage, and he kind of got lucky on the Electoral College and Comey.
And that there's a real cost to it. I mean, the other
thing. But they don't. But being a winner, I've seen that very much over the last 18 months.
Washes
away a lot. He's president. And being president makes a huge difference because parties are accustomed to following their president. I suppose it's also maybe just a tipping point issue where, I mean, from your argument, you could say that the Republican Party hung on to certain policy positions that were longer than the electoral base of the party might have suggested.
Democrats.
And, let's get to the Democrats in a minute. But then you sort of hit a moment, maybe it's one election of a particular person, and everyone looks up and says, why do we have that position?
Yeah.
And suddenly the party doesn't really want to be in the business of international world leadership and nation building. And it's not that this party isn't so great on free trade and the enlightened, immigration position that a Bush-McCain types tried to pursue. This party isn't really there. And so these things happen incrementally in terms of, as you've been saying, in terms of the elections, but maybe in a sort of tipping point way in terms of one election can really,
what's the
trigger
saying?
Or what's that?
What's the saying? People go bankrupt little by little and then all at once?
Yeah,
I mean, parties change little by little and then all at once when someone calls the bluff.
And you think this change is sort of for good?
Well,
or at least
I'm
deeper.
Not sure.
Just flip back.
It's hard to flip back because if you think about what's happening, both, again, in the elected officials and the electoral coalition, the voters and the voices inside of Congress that you're most likely to lose are the ones who are probably least on board with this. So essentially, in this election, I'm sure we'll talk about this more later.
No, we're talking about now. Well, 2018.
In 2018, it's still an open question to me whether Democrats get to the 218 majority. And we can talk about why. I think more likely than not they do, but I don't think it's at all guaranteed. But what is guaranteed is that Republicans are going to lose a lot of white collar in a suburban seats that they have been holding on to, that in places that have been voting Democratic increasingly for president. And you have Republicans in the suburbs of Philly and the suburbs of Chicago, the suburbs of Minneapolis, New Jersey, the LA media market, Orange County, and the Steve Knight seat in the exurbs, maybe even the suburbs of Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, Omaha, and Kansas City, some combination of those. Denver, suburbs of Denver, a lot of white-collar suburban seats are at huge risk, if for no other reason than that Trump is facing historic levels of disapproval and backlash among college-educated white women. It's easy. I mean, Democrats usually win college white women. So you can say, well, does that matter? Well, Democrats win college white women, but their highest share of the vote among them in a House race, according to the exit poll, since 1992 is 52%.
Nationally.
Nationally. Yeah. And Clinton won 51% of them. Okay, in almost every, so she won them, but it wasn't like, a blowout. Today, there's a whole flurry of polls out this week as we're talking in state.
Late June
in Senate races and House races. And Trump's disapproval among college white women is roughly 60 or more in all of them. And Democrats in many of these races are pushing 60% among college white women. You combine that with even a minor erosion, which is, there's some erosion among college white men, not anything like this, but something. And I don't like Barbara Comstock in Northern Virginia. I don't see how they make that work. Some of the seats in New Jersey, some of the seats in California. So there are going to be fewer white collar Republicans. On the other hand,
fewer congressmen representing white collar districts.
Fewer Republicans representing white collar districts, and fewer white collar voters in the Republican coalition. On the other hand, whether you look at the polls or the act, and by the way, this was reflected in the election results in Virginia and Alabama very dramatically. I mean, Northern Virginia, white collar, affluent, diverse, that's the kind of suburbs we're talking about. Info age, right? Not a lot of people, fracking.
Right.
I mean, there are seats like that. We'll talk about that. But, these are mostly people who work in info age jobs in places that are thriving. Northern Virginia, the five big suburban jurisdictions in Northern Virginia, Alexandria, Arlington, Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William, which are tougher because they're further out. Ralph Northam, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, had a raw vote margin in those five counties in 2017 that was larger than Obama's in 2012 in a presidential year. Okay, that's insane.
Just to make that even, and Ralph Northam is a
moderate,
boring, if I can
say,
Democrat from somewhere in the
south
of the state, who voted for Bush in 2004, and is like old school Democrat.
Right.
So the
suburban, the backlash against Trump in diverse white collar suburbs, particularly but not exclusively among women, is real, and it will take out a bunch of seats. Now, whether they get to 24, you know, we'll talk about that in a minute. I don't know if it takes out 24. It could. I mean, Republicans could lose 28, 30 seats like that, but it's also possible they only lose 18 to 20 like that, because to get all the way up, you have to start winning in places like the suburbs of Houston and Dallas, which are tougher because more of these white-collar professionals are also evangelical Christians. So it makes it – could happen. It may happen, but it may not. And the reason why that's so critical is because there's much less evidence of Republican erosion in blue-collar and non-urban seats. If you look at the vote for Roy Moore, even Roy Moore and Ed Gillespie in Virginia among non-college whites, it was still astronomical. Even among the women, it was in the 70s, or roughly 70% non-college white. I mean, admittedly, this also, you look at the vote in rural areas, the turnout, the margins were as good or better as for Trump. The turnout wasn't as high as it was in the suburban areas, which is a problem for Republicans when you have a district that combines both. But if you have a place that's
based, a statewide election.
But if you have a House seat that's essentially a rural, heavily blue-collar district, there is little evidence so far that a lot of them are at risk for Republicans. I mean, Democrats don't need that many of them, and they may be able to pick off a couple here or there. There's one in Northeast Ohio. There's one in the Central Valley of California.
It helps if they pick off a few. Rahm Emanuel famously did pick off a few in 2006. It's a little hard to get to the majority
on the white-collar side. Because if you have to put all of the weight on the white-collar side, you have to win in some places that are harder to win. And you also have to beat some people who are hard to beat.
Right. Candidates matter still.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
Mike Kaufman is in a seat that Democrats should have won by now.
Right.
And, you know, they've run some pretty good candidates, actually. Former Speaker of the State House and others. And he keeps winning.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, again, I think that much as, you know, in 2010, people like Chet Edwards and Gene Taylor and Rick Boucher and Ike Skelton and John Spratt were all Democrats who had represented rural areas in many cases, the ones I mentioned, since the 1980s. And they had survived the 94 Clinton backlash, they survived W's election, they had survived the 02 surge toward Republicans post 9/11. They could not survive 2010 when their voters were deeply exercised about a president from the other party who was really moving forward on the agenda, as, you know, Affordable Care Act, stimulus, cap and trade through the House on climate change. They could not survive that. They all lost. And I think there will be people like that. I mean, there are going to be there'll be races that weren't on our radar, like in North Carolina. They're going to be white. They're going to be a lot of white.
And their retirements that reflect that ahead of time,
right,
too,
exactly.
Which makes some of these seats open seats, which is easier.
Which was almost impossible to win. It's almost impossible to win an open seat that voted the other way for president. You need the incumbency, yeah. I think my friend David Wasserman, who works for Charlie Cook, calculated that there is not a single example of the president's party holding a seat that voted for the other side in the presidential race, going back to like 1994 or 92 during a midterm. It just doesn't happen very
often.
So, but again, the other side of the equation is this rural thing. And small town, not only rural, small town and rural, it's blue collar. And, it is possible Democrats win 5 or 6 or maybe 8, if it goes really well, seats in that terrain, and they get over the hump. But whether they get over the hump or not, I think what you end up with is a Democratic Party that is increasingly hegemonic in blue-collar metros, including the inner suburbs, and a lot of affluent places with a lot of white-collar and diverse voters, and a Republican Party that is really barely dented in its hold on rural, small-town, blue-collar America. And the trench between these two, what I call the trench, just gets bigger. And the sense after the election that we are living in two different countries that now each has a party, all the cherries lining up, you know, arrayed against the other, I just think it's going to be really profound. But, and by the way, we could see basically the same thing in the Senate, where it's entirely possible that Democrats win Arizona and Nevada, maybe Tennessee, which doesn't quite even fit into this, but Arizona and Nevada get really close in Texas, which are diverse, you know, young states that have big immigrant presence. There are only 9 Republicans in the Senate out of the 20 states that have the most immigrants, and 2 of them are Arizona and Nevada. They lose those. But offsetting that, Republicans could make further gains in kind of the heartland, predominantly white, still majority Christian states like North Dakota, Indiana, Missouri, and maybe West Virginia. So again, the Senate could be further trenched. What's the word? Betrenched? Entrenched?
I don't know.
Is there a verb? Is there a verb that goes with trench?
Separated by trenches, yeah. Entrenched and separated.
Yeah, entrenched and separated by trench.
That's what you're talking about, yeah. What about the Democrats? So Northam in Virginia, it strikes me as a Virginia resident, gave them the best of all worlds. He had a super energized Democratic base, energized by the claim, which made with some justice, that Gillespie had run a gubernatorial campaign that was Trumpy, and unattractive to the voters he needed to win over in Northern Virginia. But he was from Southern Virginia, and a little hard to demonize him as just a left-wing lunatic and all this.
Kind of all that stuff.
How much is – so there was – as we're speaking on – in late June, there was just last night a primary in New York. It's a safe Democratic seat, so it doesn't matter in a way. But Joe Crowley, an old school Democrat, loses to a 28-year-old Latina
Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders organizer. Yes.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that would – so the cultural trench starts to get wider.
Does. Well, so a couple of things. First, there is no clear ideological pattern so far in the Democratic primaries. It just isn't happening. I mean, some places, the more Sanders-like candidate has won, often to the lament of party leaders. I think California, Irvine running against Mamie Walters, they nominated a candidate. They picked a left candidate over center. Omaha against Don Bacon, they picked a left candidate over the center.
Charlottesville, which I think was a winnable seat, they picked a very left
but
candidate.
But it's not consistent. I mean, against John Culberson, the centrist won, and they have a lot of centrist candidates winning too. So that isn't a clear pattern. The clearest pattern is that women are winning. Women are just dominating in Democratic primaries. Right. I mean, they are.
Which is true. Incidentally, last night we said we should have emphasized a 28-year-old woman who worked for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, the college white women and African American women are the epicenter of the backlash to Trump, right? Those two groups. So to me, it's not surprising that they are nominating so many women, and in places where there were competitive races and women and men, women are winning the clear majority of them so far. And to me, there is a natural synergy for that in these white collar places where it's women who are driving the Democratic opportunity, and there's a risk to Republicans of a extensive or lasting realignment, because at a moment when these white-collar white women who have been like a 52-45 kind of constituency are looking at the Republican Party of Trump and saying, I don't feel at home here, the alternative they're seeing in many of these seats are women who look exactly like them. And I think that could be a very annealing or kind of solidifying factor. But the challenge for Democrats is whether this surge of female candidates can help them get over the hill with the blue-collar white women, where they're not doing nearly as well. I mean, I was looking this morning at some of these state polls, and, generally speaking, Trump's disapproval among college white women, it was Arizona, Ohio, and Florida, is somewhere between 55 to 60%. His disapproval among non-college white women in all of these states was only 40%. I mean, among the other gaps that we saw in 2016 that were the biggest ever, at least as I calculated it, or the biggest in recent memory, was the gap between the way college and non-college white women voted. And that was as big as it's ever been. I mean, it's, there was a huge gap. And I think Republicans have lost some ground among college white women, largely around healthcare security, but nothing like what we're seeing on the upscale side. And does this surge of female candidates help them do that?
Yeah, less ground among non-college white women, I think you had said.
They've lost less ground among non-college than college.
Than among college, yeah.
Yeah. Do women candidates help them with the blue-collar white women? I'm not really sure it does. I think it does help with the college white women who kind of see the kind of social point of this and may see, relate to breaking the glass ceiling as a kind of parallel to their own life. But, blue-collar white women, like minority women, are a really economically strained group and are, making social points kind of falls back on the list in terms of their electoral priorities. I do think that this election, because it's a House and Senate, because congressional, there's hundreds of elections, will not answer the fundamental choice for Democrats, which is what you're getting at. So, I mean, I think if you look at 2020 and, the Armageddon we're heading toward.
Yeah, let's go to 2020.
Because we're heading toward like absolute Armageddon, I think, as a country. The fundamental choice for Democrats is, I guess I would call it, I've never quite phrased it this way, but reassure or mobilize. Is your primary, no nominee can do everything. So do you pick a nominee whose primary strength is that they will be reassuring to center-right voters who ordinarily vote Republican but find Trump personally and morally repulsive and are thus open to voting for a Democrat. It's like, is your primary goal to kind of harvest the pieces of the usual coalition that have been dislodged and left loose by the battering ram of Trumpism? Or is your primary goal to mobilize the elements of the Democratic coalition that are not uneasy about him? They are terrified and infuriated. And, you know, if I had a bet today, I would bet pretty confidently that, and I suppose it could go the other way, but that both of those perspectives will be represented on the ticket. And that the question is, which one do you put on the top? It matters a lot.
And the Democrats I've talked to, now this could be wrong, we should challenge that, is claim that that tension is not as great as the sort of intra-Republican tension. That there, I mean, the Republican base hates, in a certain sense, the world of the Republican donors, the world of the Mitt Romney and Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, in so many cultural ways, as well as having genuine economic interests that are different. The Democratic base isn't exactly where wealthy Democrats are, and there are differences among Democratic constituencies. Obviously, African Americans and Latinos have different, you know, lives than upper middle class suburban women, white women, and all that. But that it's more of a continuum, and you can sort of imagine, one Democrat put it to me this way, you can imagine someone who's reassuring sort of on economic issues, not a social, like a socialize everything. You still get to be a high tech, you know, an IT person in a firm or a little, or tech entrepreneur or whatever, but very sort of militant on guns, militant on protecting
gay rights.
And so you sort of can, you know, navigate that, is at least the hope, I suppose, of the Democrats, the way, in a certain way, you could say Reagan or Bush navigated, George W. Bush navigated that among Republicans. But of course, whether, you know, in a real primary, if you get a real...
Well, that's what happens. I mean, primaries magnify the differences. And, you know, historically, I mean, the phrase that I turned in the mid-2000s, you know, or I guess around 2000, was the wine track and the beer track, right? I mean, the Democratic Party divided between one candidate who was basically the candidate of the white upscale liberals on the wine track, and a beer track candidate who was the candidate of blue-collar Democrats and minorities, which at that point were mostly African-Americans. And, you know, that was McCarthy versus Humphrey and Kennedy, and it was
Mondale versus Gary Hart.
Hart was the wine track, Mondale was the beer track, Clinton was the beer track, Tsongas was the wine track, Gore was the beer track, Bradley was the wine track. And you see the pattern. The wine track always loses to the beer track until you got to 2008, where Obama scrambled. He moved African-American voters over from the beer track to the wine track. He basically combined African-Americans and upscale whites. And Clinton had Hispanics, which by then were big constituencies, and blue collar whites. And it turned out that Obama's thing was like that much bigger. I mean, it was tight. It was almost a tie. And 40 million people voted. It was crazy. I mean, it was insane. And then, you know, get to 2016, and they kind of get scrambled again. But by and large, you know, the biggest problem Sanders had is that African American and Hispanic voters were really not interested in his revolution. Like they are very practical voters with real needs, much like the blue collar white women. I mean, they're, you know, they kind of got real needs. When you've got real needs, you're kind of less interested in making these kind of, you know, ideological points. So you had this kind of big generational divide, and whites split about evenly, but he never cracked minority voters, who turned out to be a tremendous bulwark for sanity in the Democratic Party, you know, which is an interesting dynamic, as opposed to, you know, they don't get quite on the flights of fancies of some of the white liberal. Now, again, I cannot sit here in 2018 and say that one strategy is definitely better than the other. I don't think it, to me at least, it's not empirically certain that reassuring center-right whites who don't like Trump is a better strategy than turning out more millennials and minorities who loathe Trump and college white women, right? You know, so I don't know which way it's going to go. You know, you could easily imagine a ticket that put, I mean, if you had a bet today, you would bet they, most party leaders would prefer reassure as the nominee, mobilize as the vice president. So, you know, that gives you Biden and Kamala Harris, Sherrod Brown and Kamala Harris, Chris Murphy and Cory Booker, you know, something like that. But it's not inconceivable that it could flip. I mean, it's not at all inconceivable to me it could flip. And, you know, if you really wanted to double down as Clinton did when he picked Gore, I mean, imagine if you just doubled down all the way. I mean, you went new coalition, new coalition.
Right.
And you say, you know what? I do not think against a Trump who is not only feeding racial anxieties, but also maybe pulling out of NAFTA and doing all of these other things, that we're really going to win back a lot of blue-collar white voters in the Midwest. And if we're going to win these states, it's because black voters are going to come out in Detroit, and millennials are going to come out in Ann Arbor, you know, and Milwaukee and Madison and, you know, the equivalent in Wisconsin. That's how we're going to win these states. So let's have Kamala Harris and
Joaquin Castro.
Yeah, or Seth Moulton.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you know, they might want one white person on the ticket.
But no, Moulton, so they get the youth.
Yeah, something young. So maybe they go that way. I think if you look at the decline, and if you look very specifically at the decline in black turnout from 12 to 16, 7 points in one election, I think that's the biggest ever recorded, went from 66% of eligible to 59% of eligible. If there is not an African-American person on the Democratic ticket in 2020, I will be stunned. I really
that's
would
interesting.
Be.
Interesting. Say a word about the millennials, because we didn't, I think, cover that quite as much when we were going through the different groups. I mean, so the gulf among millennials, I mean, is... It's always been generation gaps, and there've been whatever.
Yeah.
But you,
right. it's first of all, in 2018, for the first time ever, millennials will exceed baby boomers as a share of the eligible voters. And by 2020, it'll be there'll be a little bit of a margin, and the first post millennials will be entering the electorate. I think by 2024, the projection is that the millennials and the post millennials, or Generation Z, or whatever they are being called, they're going to be about 45 to 47% of all eligible voters. So the future is coming. The problem is
they vote less,
and so there. This is actually Charles Franklin of Marquette had a very nice chart about this. The history is that their turnout is increasing from election to election at basically the same rate as Gen X and the baby boom and the silent generation, but they started at a lower point. So they're lower at each age than the generations that are older than them, even though they're going up at the same rate. And they also really severely fall off from presidential to midterms in each of the last three, well, certainly the last two. From 08 to 10 and 12 to 14, millennial turnout was less than half as big in the midterm as it was in the presidential 2 years earlier. That's worse than it is for older groups. And that's a real threat for Democrats because
In 2018,
because one of the clearest costs of Trumpism is, you know, except for non-college white millennials, especially men, he is really, really defining the Republican Party to the millennial generation as a party of white racial resentment, I think. And you're talking about...
leaving even aside that characterization, he's certainly defining it as a party of older white people.
Of older white people, right.
And what, a majority of millennials are not...
No, millennials are about 40 to 45% non-white. A majority of the next generation will be non-white. You know, among millennial women, there are, Pew and others have put a 45-point Democratic Party ID advantage. And the gender thing is real. Interestingly, you know, I think if I'm remembering this, I think correctly, if you look at white millennials, Romney beat Obama, like tiny, narrow, among both college and non-college white millennials, narrowly. By 2016...
Obama destroyed him among, obviously,
the non-white millennials. Yeah. By 2016, Clinton beat Trump by 20 points among the college white millennials, and Trump beat her by like 20 points among the non-college white millennials. So the white population is splitting along the same, divide. But the non-white millennials, the problem for Democrats was both turnout, and then they splintered. Too many of them splintered off. I mean, corralling them, finding a way to channel the, you know. I don't think revulsion is too strong a word. The revulsion at Trump among non-white millennials into votes for Democrats is a critical mission for both 18 and 20. And that's why I think, you know, someone who they think can speak to, you know, younger non-white America in a way that neither Clinton nor Tim Kaine was really equipped to do or symbolize, it's just indispensable for them, because over 35, even now in the generic ballot, Republicans are very competitive, even for 2018. And Trump has some erosion among seniors who are, mostly white and thus mostly Republican. I mean, he won over 60% of whites over 45. I don't think he's quite in a position to do that again, but it isn't going to collapse.
So 2018, what happens after? So I guess we should walk through. They could, Democrats could or couldn't win the House.
Yeah. Maybe a little more, more likely, I think, after the chaos on the border, I think that provides such a resonant symbol for Democratic constituencies of what Trump governance gives you that I've got to think, yeah, on balance, they probably win the House. But again, not guaranteed if they can't make a little more inroads in blue-collar places.
And Senate. Slightly more the other way on Republicans, more likely to hold it than not.
But although they could, it's interesting, they could lose the three seats. I mean, they could lose three seats.
Right, and then they have to win two back.
They have to win two back, which doesn't seem that hard in that there are 10 Democrats running in states.
But they're incumbents.
Trump won. And incumbents from the party out of the White House, I believe only two of them have lost in the last 25 years in a midterm.
But they're incumbents in the Democrats have incumbents running in their most vulnerable seats, which is a big help to them. If those were open seats,
there'd be a lot of trouble.
They're gone in Missouri and North Dakota.
If you look at the party that doesn't hold the White House, so that would be Republicans in 2014 and 2010, Democrats in 2006 and 2002, Republicans in 98 and 94, going all the way back over all those elections. From the party that doesn't hold the White House, during a midterm election, I believe only two Senate incumbents have lost in the past 25 years.
Despite waves against the
party. Despite waves,
that's where Claire McCaskill, Heidi Heitkamp, those people really help the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, can they avoid any of them losing, given that Trump is still strong in those states? Seems unlikely, but the history is that Republicans can't really count on any of them.
Right.
And then you have this weird thing in Florida where, you know, Scott has so much money and all of the Rick Scott, the governor.
A two-term governor.
And he's a formidable candidate. So, you know, out of those four, really, I mean, West Virginia seems to be fading a little bit, but out of Indiana, North Dakota, Missouri, and Florida, can Republicans pick up two? And for that matter, can Democrats get the third one? Can they, in the end, tip Tennessee?
Right.
I don't know.
And there'll be some surprise somewhere. Well, anyway, but it's going to be close.
It's going to be close.
So it's after Election Day. Let's just say
it could be 50-50 Democrats, Senate, Democrats plus four in the House.
Right. What happens? What does the country look like? What happens over the next months and year in the run-up to 2020? A lot of people, when we were especially in the election business, I find you talk to them, there's 2018, and then they sort of have this. Then the next thing that happens is the primaries.
Yeah.
Beginning in January 2020, there's a year of stuff in between. I mean, I suppose by your analysis, if you got these two parties that are less like each, that have less overlap, so to speak, more
trench,
a bigger and deeper trench between them. That's really your point.
Yes.
The trench is both wider and deeper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
what happened? I mean, I guess what happens is just
I think the
warfare on Capitol Hill.
The safest prediction is that Democrats really subpoena and investigate Trump very heavily in the House. And I think they pass something on healthcare. They don't pass single payer, but I would think even with a narrow majority, they could pass an enhanced public option from 2010 that Joe Lieberman personally killed as a Democratic senator, said he wouldn't vote for it. You know, in one of the great little history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, that the principal sponsor of it now is Chris Murphy, the Democratic senator from Connecticut. I think they can pass something like that to kind of put a down payment on healthcare. The more interesting question is, could they pass immigration reform out of the House? Would depends on which Republicans survive,
right?
If Pete Sessions, Will Hurd, Jeff Denham, and David Valeto all survive by the skin of their teeth in heavily Hispanic districts, and Mimi Walters, well, probably not her, she probably wouldn't vote for it, but would they vote with Democrats to provide a pathway to, you know, basically reprise the 06 or 13 Senate bills,
which
double digits Republicans voted for each time. Beyond that, I don't know, minimum wage? I mean, they're, you know,
well,
kind of
depends on what Mueller founds, obviously, in terms of
impeachment. Yeah, that is the biggest question. Do they impeach Trump?
That's a huge wild card.
I think
the Mueller report is just, you just don't know what's in it.
Yeah, we don't know what's in it. I mean, I think they will resist impeaching Trump unless
Mueller really
puts it in their lap, because—
But he could, if he says,
could.
I think there was arguably a kind of obstruction of justice that arguably rises to the level of impeachment. Here's my 162-page account of everything they did. I don't know. What do the Democrats— They have to have hearings. They can't
Yes, they do.
Say, well, it's not our political interest to advance this, so suddenly you have hearings and the House Judiciary Committee.
I don't know what happens.
I mean,
I don't think it is in their political interest to advance it. I mean, because what Trump has done very effectively and does all the time is basically say, any attack on me is an attempt to stifle and silence you.
Right.
This is the elites who don't want the working people of the country to have a voice. They've been running things for so long. They've had it comfy and cozy. And here I am letting you in. And that's a powerful connection and argument for him.
And meanwhile, in the Senate, if the Republicans hold it, incidentally, there's probably an even more intense effort to get judges on the courts and everything done in a regular...
What happens
and, and regulations upheld so that even if the House tries to block them, the Senate doesn't.
What happens in a 50-50 Senate?
Pence breaks a tie.
All the time.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to remember back before Jeffords... First of all, you know, I guess Flake and Corker will be gone. The first question will be, is there anybody who, like Jim Jeffords, the Republican senator in 2001, withdrew from the Republican Party, became an independent, caucus with the Democrats, flipped the 50-50 Senate? That would be the first question, whether anybody would do that. Because I actually think a 50-50 Senate is a very reasonable possibility.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats win two or three, Republicans win one or two, and you're at 50-50.
And I would say just another sort of wild card to think about. Or doesn't, if it's 50-50 or close to it, 51-49, don't Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski get together with Doug Jones of Alabama and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, mm-hmm. newly reelected, presumably, and say, this is nuts. I mean, this is, we need to work together. We need to change the rules so that there's more bipartisanship. We can't have the leader by himself stopping a bill that gets reported out of judiciary 14-7, like the Mueller Protection Act, mm-hmm. just blocked because the leader says so. We want to change this, this, and this. And I'm not voting, you know, we're not letting you organize the Senate until you listen to us. And of course, on the House side, it's not so clear.
That would be very different from the way they've approached the first 2 years of Trump.
Yes.
It's always been there. I mean, you know, kind of, you know, people just talk about flakeism, you know,
right.
like, you know, kind of high-minded sentiment
right.
followed by ritualistic voting for what right. Trump wants and needs.
And there's a lot of, I think, loyalty to McConnell among
yeah.
the Republican senators, so maybe they don't quite jump ship in that way. But I don't know. One can imagine.
And you're saying the House. You're saying the House. I mean,
I think there, Pelosi, it's a real question mark of whether Nancy Pelosi is speaker, right?
I think, if the Democrats have a big majority, if the bottom falls out and they get to 240 something, yeah, maybe. But it's almost a syllogism that if they have a narrow majority, the people who won that majority will be people who promise not to vote for her for speaker.
And they can't just reverse.
Well,
they can't vote against her in the conference. She wins the conference vote 140 to 80.
They could,
80,
but that would
and
be...
then on the floor, they say, well, the conference decided, so I'm going to vote for her.
How many political advisors would advise you that your first vote in a district that is a marginal district
where
by
you,
definition...
Where you said 150 times, I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi for speaker.
I don't see it.
To
Plus,
agree.
What's the value of it? I mean, it's like, you know, the Democratic Party is the party of younger, diverse America. And they have this geriatric leadership in both the House and the Senate. And for that matter, they have a pretty gray, tilting top of the presidential field.
Yeah.
You know, Warren, Sanders, Biden are probably the best known three.
Yeah.
At some point, they have to make the generational leap. And whatever else you think about what House Republicans have done, and certainly what Paul Ryan has done in the last few years, he represented that leap from Boehner. I mean, they took a big, I mean, was it, what, 15 years between them or something like
yeah,
that?
At least. Well, I want to get back to Ryan in a second. I think it's such an interesting
I think he will be the tragic figure of the Trump era, I think.
But with Crowley losing, it's last night as we speak here in late June, in Queens to a 28-year-old, it's not clear who the heir to Pelosi is, and maybe that's a good thing for the Democrats in that they have an actual race and they elect some 45-year-old speaker, and it looks, whoa, it's a little different than it was. And maybe they wipe out Hoyer from the leadership, too, and maybe even Clymer, and suddenly it could be. So I think people who think, well, there'll be an election, and then Washington will look exactly the way it looks today, plus or minus, you know, in terms of the seats, but same leadership, sure, people we know well, we've seen them work or not work together. It could be very different.
It could be very different.
I mean, certainly.
And Ryan
will be gone. So the House you could have actually, which means all that control they had in both parties, really, over their members and the ability to enforce discipline on the Republican side and not bring things to the floor, majority is needed.
Right.
I'm not so sure that holds.
Yeah.
I mean, in a new situation in the House.
Well, as I said, I mean, you look at immigration, I mean, it depends who survives among the Republicans. A part of the issue is how badly are the white-collar metro Republicans expunged in this election. And, there's always the risk in this kind of thing is that all the ones who might have voted with you as a Democrat, you'll beat. But if some of those survive and you get more of a checkerboard kind of election where some of the blue-collar Republicans lose but not all of the white-collar Republicans lose, I think a return Jeff Denham would vote for comprehensive immigration reform.
And remember, the gang of the 2013 bill began in the Senate, died in the House. I got 68, I think, votes in the Senate.
No, the first one did, the 06 one. This one got like 62. Only 13 Republicans voted for it. No, the
and
13.
Final passage. Maybe there's a slightly
higher vote. I could see that being something in the House could. But yeah.
But the Senate could go first. I mean, Cory Gardner, looking at the results, could decide, gee, in Colorado, I should be for this. And yeah, he voted for it last time, probably.
He voted for the Grassley bill, which would have, you know, kind of the Trump. I was assigned, Cory Gardner and David Perdue would be the 2020 Republicans in diverse states. Gardner, I think, is going to be not going to be easy for him in Colorado in a presidential year. Perdue, obviously, a stronger situation. But in a presidential year, Georgia is getting to, you know, getting to the point where if a Democrat wanted to invest in it, they could make it really close. You know, again, the variable there is how many of those white-collar suburbanites are willing to break away from Trump and the Republicans, less than in Colorado and New Jersey and Virginia, but more than in Georgia 10 years ago, maybe. So, you know, there's some, and by the way, look on the kind of the little things to kind of put on your scorecard for November, what share of college whites does Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic nominee in Texas, win against Ted Cruz? Probably doesn't beat Ted Cruz, but maybe keeps it really close. And if he gets into the 40s among college whites and you project that out with a presidential, not an off-year Hispanic turnout, all of a sudden 2020, Texas is not someplace you can ignore as a Republican. Again, not that Democrats would be the favorite. But once you start getting into the 40s among college whites, which I think is the risk to the Republican Party under Trump everywhere, that Democrats can get into the 40s among college whites, even in these southern states, there's a math to put together at that point if you can generate more Hispanic turnout. And plus, you erode the usual respectable Republican performance with Hispanic in Texas, which is usually pretty good. You know, again, is Trump putting that at risk? You know, you'd have to think so. Not necessarily a lot of evidence of it yet, but you'd have to think so sooner or later.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, it seems to be implicit in your argument throughout this is if the Republicans are the party of older people, whiter people, and less well-educated people, those are three declining categories of the general population. So ultimately, Trump, I mean, I do think this is the simple but probably true. Trump drew an inside straight, lost the popular vote by, what, 2.8 million or something.
He lost by a lot. He lost it by more than W won it in 04.
Yeah. He draws the inside straight on the Electoral College.
Yeah.
I mean, with a slightly less favorable electorate, as an incumbent who can't just be running on promises, but actually has antagonized some Harley-Davidson workers in Wisconsin and some farmers in Iowa and so forth because of tariffs. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, people right now, Trump's powerful, he's independent. Ooh, look how tricky recovery is to mobilize his base. But it all feels to me, it's not so obvious how Trump wins
in 2020. Well, the question is, I mean, and this goes beyond Trump, is whether partisan change outweighs demographic change. And the risk to Democrats is that there is a treadmill. And the treadmill, as I call it, is that as the white share of the population declines, as the non-college white share of the population declines, as the white Christian share of the population declines, a bigger portion of that shrinking group basically views the Republican Party as their champion. And so the Republican share of the vote goes up, even as the group's share of the total electorate goes down, and you end up roughly in the same place. You know that you, if the blue collar white, the non-college white share of the electorate, whether you use the exit poll or the census, is pretty much declining 2 points every 4 years. But if Republicans move from 61 to 67, and possibly move even higher in 20, you still net out the same number, roughly the same number of votes, or maybe even more votes from that group. So how far can that process extend? To what extent is the movement toward Republicans among these groups a factor, a result of their declining overall status in the electorate? Now, that doesn't work forever, and it doesn't work in the near term even if the Democratic constituencies make the same judgment and say, well, you know what, if this is kind of like this quasi-racial, quasi-generational proxy war between the two parties, I've got to vote at the same levels as those guys. But for a while, you know, especially given the distribution of the population, that diversity is not evenly distributed across the country, that places like Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin are all getting older and they're not getting much less whiter, you might be able to do the inside straight a couple of times. But, you know, when you look at something like 2/3 of millennial women calling themselves Democrats at this point, you say, you know, there's a real cost to this.
I mean, could you have two elections in a row? It's a matter of, I'm not a big, you know, populist majoritarian.
Yeah, yeah.
But could you have two elections in a row, which would then be three of the last six, I guess, all to Republicans' advantage,
yes,
where they've lost the popular vote and win the Electoral College? At some point, that gets a little,
to
happen once every 50 or 80
it
years.
It happened three times between the founding and 1996.
Yeah.
And it potentially is going to happen three times in 20 years after three times.
I think you do get, I mean, that's a real.
So the first election was 1788. Was it?
No.
1792.
Yeah, 1788.
78 was the first one, right?
Yeah.
And then he got reelected. So 1788 to 1996 is 208 years. It happened three times.
Right.
And then it's going to happen three times in 20 years?
Yeah.
Clearly something is happening. And what's happening is that, you know, as I said, I mean, you essentially have a big series of demographic, cultural, and economic transformation that is bypassing big chunks of the country that feel excluded, if not threatened, by it. And so you have this kind of weird disjunction where all of the biggest places in the country, even in the red states, Salt Lake City, Houston, Atlanta, Dallas, those metros are moving toward the Democrats. And Republicans are just dominant in the smaller, predominantly white, rural, mostly Christian places. So the idea of the Electoral College diverging from the popular vote does seem to be something that could happen more often. And where this really comes to a head, though, it has to be the Senate, right? I mean, the Senate is, you know, if we added up the votes right now to 51-49 Senate, of all the votes that the Democratic senators got and all the votes that the Republican senators got.
Yeah, and it's been done, I think.
It would not be close.
It's like 60-40, 58-42 Democrat. It's not that close.
It would not be that close. And, you know, imagine this scenario. Trump loses the popular vote in 16 and wins. Republicans lose the popular vote in the 2018 House race and hold the House, and Trump loses the popular vote and wins again in 2020. You know, at what point does the rubber band snap? I mean, I think, blue America, now we have this 5-4 Republican majority in the Supreme Court. Roberts has kind of shed his earlier hesitation, I think, about, you know, kind of that having that alignment over and over again. It just kind of, it was almost like an assembly line or a stamping press this month, you know, rolling out those five Republican justices, outvoting the four Democratic justices, with that fifth seat being one that will be controversial forever because of McConnell refusing to hold a vote on it. All of this, I think, just deepens the trench and goes to the larger point of, how much does red and blue America really want to be in one country anymore?
I'm going to argue slightly against that here as we close up, maybe, because I think that's such an interesting, deeper question, really, that the electoral analysis raises. But, I mean, just another wild card. Of course, Mueller's a big wild card. Of course, what the economy does and foreign policy and stuff will affect the overall result. I mean, these demographic groups aren't so locked in that they're not affected by a recession on the one hand or affected the other way by decent economic growth on the other. But the court is a huge one. I think that brought back just a key margin of college-educated white Republicans in 2016 because the Scalia seat was up to Trump. I don't like Trump. I don't approve of him. Some of this stuff is crazy on tariffs and even immigration. But you know what? The courts is long-term. We're going to have a court that's going to be conservative. I think that was a –
I
personally know people who made this argument.
I agree. But let me interrupt there because it goes to my point, which is that if you feel the – divergence between what you get out of a Democratic majority court and a Republican majority court is so profound that you are willing to vote for a guy who you think as temperamentally unsuited, misogynistic, racist, and volatile because what you want out of the court is so different than what Hillary Clinton would give you. That, to me, underscores the underlying point, which is the divide is not only in Washington. The divide is in the country. And I'm not sure how we get out of a situation where roughly 49% of the country feels deeply aggrieved and alienated at all times, while 51% is not even really breathing easy, just kind of, you know, almost a sigh of relief that we're in control.
Right.
The other side can't do anything bad to us.
But I would say on the courts, incidentally, that it's not clear to me that that's a correct analysis. It's not clear to me that the courts are going to make such consequential decisions. They're not going to reverse Roe, probably, and even if they did, most, you know, the biggest states would keep keep abortion rights. They're not going to reverse same-sex marriage. So we're talking about some religious liberty decisions, which are important, but, you know, probably not at the biggest you know, the sort of in the middle of the
immigration, 30-yard line. Stuff.
Some immigration. I mean, it's not crazy for people to care a lot about the courts, but I think it's a little, that also became itself, and this in a way confirms your point, it doesn't challenge it, became itself symbolic as much as real.
Like I described 2020 as Armageddon. I mean, it feels like this just feels like the Battle of the Bulge we're heading toward. We're heading toward the Battle of the Bulge in 2020, where you have this just absolutely no holds barred, you know, conflict between blue America and red America. And yes, there will be erosion around the edges for Trump, particularly, I think, on the white collar side. But by and large, more of the Republican coalition than people anticipated, I think, are going to stick with him. And the issue is going to be, can Democrats avoid the fractionation of 2016 and also just increase turnout? And I think the answer is probably yes. And that Trump turns out maybe even more rural, blue-collar, older, evangelical whites. And we just have this sense of, like, you know, what did Roosevelt say? You probably remember 1912 when he left the Republican, walked out of the Republican convention and started the Bull Moose Party. We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord. I think like 70% of Americans are going to feel that way. And it's because Trump, and Trump didn't create any of this, but he gleefully intensifies it and exacerbates it and views widening the trench and, you know, as an asset to him, and, you know, essentially runs as a wartime president. Only the war is against blue America.
I mean, people like me hope for a primary challenge to Trump, even if there's a reset. You're doubtful of that, I'm sure.
No, I'm not. I mean, I don't think
there could be a recession, there could be foreign policy, but obviously if you
have even think you need that. Yeah. I think that a challenger could run against Trump and cause him, probably not beat him, almost certainly not beat him, but cause him serious long-term problems. Yeah. Because I think if you had a challenger from the white-collar wing of the party, that particularly in the coastal and upper Midwest states, you would see a substantial portion of college-educated Republicans vote for the challenger. Right. I mean, there's been polling in New Hampshire, for example, where only one-third of college-educated, likely Republican primary voters say they want Trump to have another term. So if you're John Kasich and you run against him and you win the suburbs of Columbus and Northern Virginia and parts of New Jersey and Connecticut and New Hampshire, you are basically sending a signal to ordinarily Republican voting, white collar voters, that it's okay. You can still be a Republican and not be for this guy. And I do think that increases the odds that more of those voters go somewhere else in the general election. So while you can't beat him,
you can
still make a point.
Yeah.
You can make a point that he does not now concede that there is a we're here. It's like, you know, it's like you'd be like, you'd be kind of shaking by the lapels. Like, hey, you cannot govern in a way that completely ignores the unease of portions of white collar Republican leaning America about your racial demagoguery and your volatility and your Twitter fights. And if you do, there's a price. Because right now, he doesn't see any price.
But also the policies. I mean, this is where I think.
Well, the policies, the trade,
you know,
and the immigration.
I mean, in particular areas, particular voters might move on. Farmers in Iowa might be upset about trade, and other people would be upset about other issues, obviously.
But I think the biggest piece would be upset about him.
Yeah,
temperament and performance.
Absolutely, and that's where the actual. One reason the border thing I think is big is that it's the actual consequences in the real world of his temperament and of his way of governing and of his views.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, on NFL, you know, national anthem stuff, some people might find it distasteful or demagogic or not really healthy for the country. But this, at the end of the day, the NFL continues and the players continue to be get several million dollars for playing. And, you know, it's sort of hard it can be dismissed. I'm struck talking to Republican reluctant Trump supporters, which seems to be about half of them from the data. Well, fewer than half of Republicans voted for Trump in 2016. If you look at the approved, somewhat approved, somewhat disapproved, strongly disapproved. Somewhat approved is about as big as strongly approved. So, you know, he's got a lot of, these are more the upper middle class, college educated Republicans who, you know, look, he's better than Hillary would have been. I like the tax cut. I like Gorsuch. Media's unfair. The left's horrible. Mm-hmm. Maxine Waters, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I think the big moment that may be underestimated now is sort of the day after Election Day this year, when it's no longer, was I right to vote for Trump over Hillary? I'm annoyed by those never-Trumpers who are always, you know, like waving their finger at me for doing this. But it becomes, do you want four additional years?
Yeah, it's a different question.
It's a perspective question. And the best actual candidate against Trump probably is someone who says, look, I understand why you voted for him, and I don't quarrel with your voting for him. I may not have, or maybe I did, you know, if I'm Nikki Haley as opposed to John Kasich or Ben Sasse. But, and he got some good things done, and, you know, we shouldn't be sound hysterical. But I don't know, you know, it's a little, the chaos, the divisiveness, a little older, you know, second term could be kind of wild, you know, without any of those constraints. Maybe we need to sort of change.
The problem would be,
kind of message you could see prying away people who did vote for him, because after all, 91% of Republicans voted for him in 2016, and people who might be telling a pollster today, still in the somewhat approved category.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge would be the blue-collar side of the party.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you're saying that's probably enough for the party just to renominate him.
Yeah, because I think what will happen is even a good challenger could split or even win the college side of the party 60-40, but he'll win the blue-collar side 80-20, and it will just add up, or maybe more. I mean, I think it's hard to win, but that doesn't mean it is futile, because...
That means you can win some delegates in some states.
But you could also, right now, he feels that he can attack Harley Davidson on Twitter or, talk about infest and invade, and he maybe could pull out of NAFTA, and that essentially the portions of the party who are uneasy with all of his racial nationalism and his volatility will be quiet and take it because they got Neil Gorsuch in a tax cut, and there's no price, there's no constraint. If somebody runs and wins 45% of college-educated Republicans and wins a majority of them in a number of coastal states, and particularly in maybe in some places that he has to win, I think Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, I think that alone is a shot across the bow, and thus makes it worthwhile for the voices in the party who don't like the direction. Because, look, there is a cost to this. I mean, you know, the possibility of Democrats winning 60% of college-educated white women and the possibility of, in 2020, 70% of millennials voting against Trump, even as they are emerging as the largest generation in the electorate. I mean, it's not like this is cost-free. I mean, there's benefits, you know, but the benefits are among groups that are shrinking.
Yeah, my fanciful Republican candidate here in 2019, late 2019, would have to also say, look, I mean, with all due respect to President Trump, he's likely going to lose in 2020. The Senate, which is already, let's just make up, is evenly divided or very close to it, has a horrible map in 2020, and we're probably going to lose the Senate. The Democrats will either hold the House if they already have it or win it back finally, if they're just down by a few seats after 2018. So you're looking, the price of renominating Trump is Democratic governance in 2021. And then the question, so let's close maybe on this, what about the Democrats, though? I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, the court discussion actually made me think about this. I mean, I don't know, the Democrats, they could go pretty radical on some of these issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would be so, what if they do jam through a nominee in 2019, McConnell succeeds in doing it because they got 53 senators or something like that. I mean, I just can imagine a Democrats, the conventional Democrats are all, you know, I like this combination, like we were saying earlier, older, younger, centrist, more, aggressive, whatever. I don't know, I'm making this up, obviously, some female Democratic law professor says, these people are all ridiculous. We need to increase the size of the Supreme Court, which is totally constitutional, to 11. If you elect me with a Democratic Congress, I will fix this outrage that's been perpetrated on us by Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
We will have a court that will allow, we'll strike down Republican efforts to, prevent minorities from voting and, all the obvious issues that want to focus on. I don't know. Could such a candidate not sort of take off in a kind of Gene McCarthy, Howard Dean sort of way?
So,
then they go there, but then if parts of, the swing voters look up and say, ooh, I don't know. I mean, is that bad? We have to change the Supreme Court. You can imagine the Democrats really being radicalized,
so,
I suspect.
As I've said to you before, I believe we are living through the modern equivalent of the 1850s. I just don't know what the modern equivalent of the 1860s looks like. But when I say that we are living through the modern equivalent of the 1850s, I mean it very precisely. The 1850s was from the Compromise of 1850 until the beginning of the Civil War, was a Cold War between the North and the South. And every issue, followed that sectional divide. Every institution in American life broke along that sectional divide. And things that were unimaginable at the beginning of the decade became imaginable. I mean, there was open combat in Missouri before the Civil War. There was the Dred Scott decision. There was the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the breakup of the Whig Party. And I think it was because at some level, a growing number of Americans believe themselves to be living in a state of civil conflict before it was, you know, a shooting war. And I think there's a parallel to now. I mean, I think that there is a growing number of at least activists on each side who believe that we are living in some sort of irrepressible, was that Seward? Irrepressible conflict,
isn't that?
Yeah. Yeah, between red and blue America. And therefore, there will be an audience for ever more radical measures, as Mitch McConnell himself demonstrated in 2016 by doing something that would not have been, I think, imaginable
probably,
40 years earlier.
Probably. But don't you think, but isn't
and therefore, even though there is a big chunk of the middle of the country that might like all of this to tamp down, the centrifugal force in both parties is such that, without that specific example, I consider it not only possible but likely that escalations of the conflict that we can't yet envision sitting here will unfold in the next 10, 15 years.
The counter argument, I suppose, would be slavery was, of course, a genuine, huge division.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of this is sort of self-generated, rhetorical identity politics. At the end of the day, is the America that most Trump voters want to live in that different from the America that most Democratic voters want to live in? They have a sort of different vision and wish and, you know, a slightly attitude towards the past and the future, but, you know, most of them are working in companies that include both of them, or maybe less than they used to, living in communities that do include some people from the others,
see, that,
but
that,
less.
That,
I guess
that,
that's
that, that part. That part, you know, you're right that there is no single issue that reaches the magnitude of slavery, but I do think there is an interlocking set of issues all around the same axis of change: demographic change, cultural change, economic change. Do you welcome it? Do you see it as improving what America is, or do you see it as transforming America into something unrecognizable? You know, on election night in 2012, when Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly both had some version of, we've lost America, you know, and make America great again being the key
word. And the Flight 93 thing, which was very indicative of in September 2016.
Right.
This is the last election to preserve some view version of
America. Preserve the kind of political predominance of white Christian small government America, maybe. You know, I mean, that all of that, I think, even without a single issue of the magnitude of slavery, that all adds up to something. You know, Seattle is very different than Trump country. And in terms of the way it looks and feels and how it makes its money and how it feels about global markets and how it feels about immigration and
the different way it gives gay, equal rights
right,
for gays,
right.
As
I mean,
opposed
these,
to,
you know,
preserving liberty for religious,
yeah,
you know, store owners and so forth.
Right. Right. All of those things are, all of those things, again, and they may not be as, you know, how many times do bakers have to choose whether sort of, it may not be as real and pervasive and omnipresent as slavery was, but there's a lot of it. And there's a lot of issues that divide the country along the same geographic, generational, racial, class line. Which itself, by the way, right, is, you know, college graduates are concentrating in fewer places. I mean, smaller places are having trouble holding on to their college graduates. I mean, if you look at the, you know, just take one powerful example. Hillary Clinton won fewer than 1/6 of the counties in America, and her counties accounted for 2/3 of the GDP. So, you know, essentially, the parts of the country that are embracing the future feel as though they are being dictated to by the parts of the country that are most fearful of that future, and the parts of the country most fearful of the future feel that, you know, the other side is transforming America into something unrecognizable. Some, you know, we're on a slalom ride to Sweden, and you know, economically, and then we're becoming this, you know, polyglot.
Right.
So I don't see. I mean, it would take extraordinary leadership to try to overcome this. I'm not sure anybody can overcome it. But what's unique about Trump is that he wants to sail into the wind. I mean, he's like he's there trying to make this wave, this current even deeper, the trench even deeper, and that's just pretty explosive.
And I suppose, you know, analytically, what everyone would wish, you have to say the odds of the next 2+ years are that the just objective events, whether it's the Mueller report, the 2018 election and its consequences, the judicial appointment, whatever, will deepen the trench, not not lead people to say, wait a second, we need to put some bridges over the trench. I mean, a crisis, I would once have said, and this is, let me close by asking this, is, I mean, what if there really were, you know, either an economic crisis, 2008, it's not like we haven't had them, a foreign policy crisis of 2001 sort of situation, 9/11. I guess I would have once said those might bring people together. I mean, in 2008, for all the hubbub, Bush and the Democratic Congress passed a bailout. Yes. A lot of people complained about it, but by the end of the day, Bernanke and those guys were able to get us out before, you know, we all caught total collapse of the world economy, and we ended up coming back, you know, as adequately, maybe more slowly than we should have, and so forth. And of course, 9/11, there was genuine unity for a year and a or two before it kind of broke apart.
The war,
yeah. I mean, I suppose it'd be an interesting question. Does a recession or a crisis cause attempt to reach across the trench, or does it just make it even worse?
I think it's very unlikely that anything could happen that could cause Blue America to put trust in Trump. I think that the view in Blue America is so overwhelming that he is unfit in every possible way.
Trump is a particular problem. I mean, I think you could,
if
Trump disappeared. Right. You could imagine, I mean, Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer.
Sure, yes. You know, but Trump is, as long as Trump is there, I think any crisis would cause Blue America to feel even more, and probably portions of Red America, that like we can't afford this craziness anymore. And people would, you know, if there was a real military crisis, then I think you would have overwhelming sentiment in kind of Blue America. And I think, as I said, even a portion of Red America saying, hey, I don't trust this guy to be making the choices about life and death.
Or conversely, I suppose if there were a terror incident, you could imagine a lot of Red America rallying to a Trump doing things that a lot of Blue America would say,
I don't think crisis makes us better. I actually think crisis makes it worse. I'm not sure what makes it better while he's there. And, you know, ultimately, what in the Republican Party, it has to be, I think the evidence is clear, it has to be shown to be a loser. Because it is not going to be a moral stand that causes a big portion of the coalition to sheer off from Trump. It's going to have to be shown that it doesn't work in the long run. And, you know, there are still those voices. You're one, Whit Ayers. There are others, Jeff Flake, who are like, hey, you know, if we're betting entirely on shrinking groups, of squeezing more blood out of shrinking stones, essentially, that can't go on forever. But, you know, politics is always, you know, is a near horizon kind of business. And I think people have to see a consequence in 2018. If they lose the House and they are annihilated in white collar suburbs, you may see more people saying in 2019, hey, do we want to repeat this exercise again in 2 years?
And one can imagine the Democrats then going in a direction that which they go off the rails in 2021. Well, whatever. So it's hard to.
Well, again, but that would not necessarily point toward that, though, because that if you won the House in white collar suburban districts,
right, that would presumably
would kind of push you more toward finding someone who can talk to those voters.
Well, that would be good if someone in each party
tried to talk to everybody,
to voters who were not. Yeah, that
right,
is
right.
I mean, this is very explicit in his speeches and his tweets. My people are best, and my voters are the greatest, and that's who I'm speaking for.
He's a wartime president. Only the war is at home.
Yeah, we've never had a president who really didn't at least pretend whatever his
to be president
political inner political judgment
or try in some way.
Yeah, in some way, just for self-interest, you know, right? Because if you get elected with a small margin, you want a bigger margin.
Bill Clinton once told me he would sit around and think about people like Jesse Helms and Pat Robertson and say, I know we disagree on 99 things. What is the one thing that I could find to have them over to the White House over that we could do something together? You know, any kind of, you know, AIDS in Africa or something. Trump is the opposite. I think Trump looks at Blue America as a foil, as a way of, you know, to kind of say to his supporters, they're coming to get you. They're coming to take away your America. And so he is a wartime president for a domestic war.
We will reconvene after Election Day and see what's happened in 2018 and the immediate aftermath. I think that could be quite interesting in Congress and elsewhere. Yeah. And then you can tell us
maybe how wrong I was.
Yes, we can both agree how wrong we both were. I don't know. And then what's going to happen in the next year. And, this has been a very instructive and not entirely encouraging or cheering conversation, but reality is reality. Ron Brownstein, thanks a lot for joining me. And thanks for joining us on Conversations.